in the town of Catskill by its planning board. We are here from Glidepath Power Solutions. We are the developer of this project and the owner-operator of it. Tonight we're going to talk about who we are, a little bit about Glidepath and our projects. And we'll spend some time on the argument for storage, how it works, why we need it on the grid here in Central Hudson Valley. And then finally a bunch of project specifics about the location, the technology. We also have here Dave Young with Chazen Companies. They are handling our site engineering and a lot of help with the permitting as well. So Dave will walk through the site plan and answer, you know, specific questions on that as well. So let's dive in. So Glidepath Power Solutions, we are one of the largest developers of energy battery storage in the U.S. We have over 1 gigawatt of projects in our development pipeline. Our role, we develop, own, and operate these energy projects. Our focus is on renewable technologies such as solar and wind and battery storage. That's where we put our focus. Our operating portfolio of clean energy projects is over 425 megawatts, and that includes storage, solar, and wind. And that's throughout the U.S. and also on the island of Guam, where we operate the largest solar project there on that island. If you want more information about our company, our website is up there. And we also have a project website that I encourage you to check out and share with your neighbors. All of the documents that we are presenting here, these posters and this presentation, are loaded on that website. So, Doreen, I don't know if that is on the town website, but that would be...
I think the link into the invitation is that we'll take it off there tonight and we'll put it...
That would be great. Okay, thank you very much. And then there is a dedicated email address as well. So anyone who has questions, you can get through the project website. There's a contact us page, but there's also an email address for the project that one of us will get and respond to. And that's whether for questions or comments about the project. The presenters, just to introduce us, we have Chris McKissick here. He's our chief operating officer. 20 years in the energy sector. He is expertise in engineering, construction management, interconnection and the power marketing. He's got an EE degree from Notre Dame and MBA from University of Chicago. Peter Rood is our chief development officer. He's my boss. So he's got 15 years energy experience and storage as well throughout North America, Micronesia, and Australia. Peter has broad experience in development, construction management, project management, and also project finance and all the renewable technologies. And he comes to us from University of Arizona with a background in natural resource management. I'm Erin Hazen. I'm a director of development at Glidepath. I joined the company just earlier this year, and I'm focused on our portfolio in New York and also on Guam, developing further projects there. And prior to joining Glidepath, I worked in the biomass industry, led a really unique project converting University of Iowa off of coal to biomass energy sources, and I've also worked for a long time in wind and solar. And then finally, as I mentioned, Dave Young. Dave is a project engineer with Chazen, and he is helping us guide this very complex project, coordinating a lot of the engineering and civil works, and he's here. He's coming to us from Pennsylvania State University. This is our operating portfolio. We have 373 megawatts of wind, as you can see, about almost 100 megawatts in battery storage, and then the solar project on the island of Guam. Okay, so here's the part we're going to talk about energy storage and how it fits in the grid in New York and how it works with renewable technologies that New York is looking to expand on. So we are at a moment where New York's infrastructure is dramatically changing. Through the Green Deal that's been approved, you're going to be raising your clean energy standards from 50 to 70% renewable electricity by 2030. Increase your distributed solar to 6,000 megawatts by 2025. Offshore wind, 9,000 megawatts. And helping this happen through it all is the deployment of battery energy storage. So 1,500 megawatts by 2025 and doubling that by 2030. This, you can see a roadmap of where current development is going on. That's kind of the near-term development portfolio in New York. It's all over the state. And storage is going to be needed to help balance these various sources of generation. And Peter's going to go into the technical reasons of how it helps, how storage makes that happen. This is from the roadmap itself, published by the state. What storage will do is going to store and provide that clean energy when and where it's most needed. So by having these distributed storage facilities like the one we're proposing here, that's accomplishing that. You're getting that energy and that balancing feature where the load is, where it's needed. And one of the key things that we'll help with is reduce the use of peaking plants. That is some of the dirtiest power on the grid and the most inefficient. And storage is really going to take a direct hit at those peaker plants. Again, we'll get into a little more detail. And then finally, job creation. It's estimated almost 30,000 jobs created in New York as a result of this build-out by 2030. Storage is supported by most of the major environmental groups in the country. So this is an excerpt from a letter that you can see these, you know, ACOR and League of Conservation Voters, Sierra Club, etc., wrote to our U.S. Congress Ways and Means Committee urging them to support energy storage because of its role of helping increase the penetration of renewables like wind and solar. GlidePath is also honored to receive the support from the New York League of Conservation Voters. So recently they wrote a letter and submitted it to the town of Catskill, promoting this project, urging its support, urging a good look at it because of the way it supports the clean energy and climate goals. They endorse the goals of this project. And finally, like I said, urging the town to consider its adoption. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Peter Rood, who's going to talk a bit about how we're going to make this happen. And we'll have questions and answers after, but please don't hesitate during this. If you have something you want to ask right now, don't hesitate to raise your hand and ask.
Great. Good evening. My name is Peter Rood. I look after all of GlidePath's development activities and have been working with GlidePath for several years in on energy storage for almost the last 6 years of my career. These kind of transition slides that we have, although they look kind of like just art we downloaded off the internet, these are actually our own projects. This is our Elwood Energy Storage Project in Illinois. It was one of the first projects that we built in 2015. Both Chris and I were involved in that project, Chris on the development side of it, and I worked on the construction part of it. But these are some of the first energy storage containers built in the United States, built in Illinois, and are operating wonderfully today and providing some of the same services that I'll talk about right now that we're planning to do with this project. They're doing that in Illinois right now, and we hope to do that here in New York. So the way energy storage projects like this one work is, first of all, the services they provide to the grid aren't necessarily the electrons that power the lights. So when you think of electricity, you think of a basic generator that runs and generates electricity so you can plug something in and use that tool or use those lights or use those that computer or whatnot. And we don't always think about are all of the pieces that go into making sure that when you flip the switch, the lights come on when you want them to, and that the lights work as they're designed to. And there's a lot of things that go into running our electric system that go beyond just generating the power. There are things like making sure that there is sufficient capacity available to meet those needs. So when you turn the lights on, there's actually electrons in the grid for you to consume, that they're not being consumed by your neighbors, and there's not excess electrons floating around, that it's perfectly matched to the amount of demand there is. So that's the capacity. It's also making sure that the frequency, which is a kind of a technical term, but it has to do with the quality of the electricity, that frequency stays within a certain range so that lights don't burn out because having too much energy go into them unexpectedly, or computers don't dim down or trip offline because there's not enough electricity. So a lot of the services that go into making electric grid work go beyond just generating energy. And traditionally, up until recently, a single power plant, a single centralized generator, like a coal plant or a large nuclear plant, could provide all of those services all at once with very complex, very large steam and thermal generators. And as we transition to a renewable grid that uses things like photovoltaic panels or wind turbines, those services aren't always as easy to provide from those technologies. Sometimes because they're not always running, you know, as you know, the sun isn't always out, the wind's not always blowing, so it's not quite as predictable, although there are good systems to forecast those things, that they're not 100% accurate. And also because the technology itself isn't as focused on providing all of those services, and rather solar, for example, is focused on providing low-cost energy. So what battery projects do is they provide those other services that some of the new renewable technologies that are being deployed can't provide or can't provide as easily. And so when you think about a project like ours, it's not so much about generating power just to generate power. It's about generating and absorbing electricity off the grid at precisely the right time so that the grid functions as it's been designed to, with all the other resources that are out there working together. The storage helps bring all those things together. So the way it works is that the project is attached to the large electric grid. So we'll be attached through Central Hudson System to the North Catskill substation. And we're going to connect right there, right along with many other distribution lines that are coming off that substation. So the North Catskill station is where Central Hudson takes the high voltage electricity that's coming in the kind of cross or cross-country transmission lines, steps that voltage down to distribution circuits that then go to each individual customer. And so we're going to connect to that system just like a regular distribution customer would, like a large industrial facility will connect to that system. And we'll have access to both the local distribution system, where most of our services will kind of stay, as well as the regional system when the services are needed on a more regional basis. So we'll be connected to that via, I think in this case, we're planning probably a combination of overhead and underground lines. Our facility is right across the street from the substations. We're not talking about building any major new lines. We're just right across the street. So we'll have a single point of connection. And then from there, within our project, we will break that line up into multiple individual battery containers. And those battery containers, as I don't know how to go back on this. How about
yeah, use the previous? Scroll wheel. You don't have to have it on the table.
So we'll have a number of these little containers, and they'll each provide a collection of batteries, and together they'll work as a larger system. So we will have a kind of internal distribution system that will connect all those containers together, and each container will have thousands of small battery cells. So we'll start with battery cells that'll be in nice tall racks. I think we have a picture coming up.
Yeah, there's one coming.
One coming up of those racks of batteries, and those racks will all be in a container. So it's little small pieces, similar, probably a little bit larger, but similar kind of concept as a cell phone. We'll have lots of small cells connected together that come in these large racks, and the racks all work together in a container, and the project consists of multiple containers. And so to make a project the size we're talking about, which is 20 megawatts by 4 hours or 80 megawatt hours total, we have lots of containers all together with, I think at the end of the day, probably close to 1 million or more individual battery cells. And they're all controlled by a centralized controller. So one plant controller runs the whole thing, makes sure that all of the commands are distributed appropriately and that everything is functioning correctly. All sorts of monitoring all the way down to the individual battery racks. We have little monitors that tell us how those batteries are doing, making sure they're all performing correctly, that we're balancing them correctly, all of those things you want to do to, you know, for us to maximize the battery life and operate the project safely. And the battery, the project operates via remote control, both from our 24-hour, 7-day-a-week control center, but also the actual battery operation is done via commands directly from the New York grid operator. So the grid operator will tell us what to do, whether to charge or discharge, and provide all those services via that remote control. And that's an automated system. So the grid operator, we connect to the grid operator, and they provide every 4 seconds a new signal of what we should be doing. And sometimes we'll be charging, sometimes we'll be discharging, but the grid operator runs our project along with dozens of other battery projects and thermal generators, gas plants, oil plants, all together to maintain those balances. So that's generally how it works. I'll stop briefly just before we move on. If you have any questions about what I just explained? Yes, sir.
So is your charging a passive system, or are you you have to go down on the markets and purchase your, like, does the electric flow through and you collect it, or do you have to go out and buy it off hours?
The function of our project, so we're providing two primary services to the grid. We're providing capacity services, and we're providing kind of real-time ancillary services, mostly what's called frequency regulation. And the frequency regulation is the second-by-second balancing of the grid. So sometimes we're charging, sometimes we're discharging, and that's kind of done on a multi-second basis. So, you know, we'll be charging for a few seconds, and then we'll get a signal to discharge, we'll discharge for a few seconds, and we'll manage all of that via how much energy is in our battery. At the same time, we'll also, on occasions, when there's a peak coming, we will charge our battery and be ready for a discharge for a capacity event, similar to the way a natural gas generator, peaking generator, might function for a couple hours. This is kind of what it's doing. But to finish answering your question, we're paid, so we sell to the market, we sell two products primarily. One is capacity, which is a product that you sell to the grid just to be there. So you're saying, I'm here, I'm ready to respond when you need me, I'm here. And we also sell this frequency regulation product, which is the second by second up and down, and that one is paid on how much you move in a given period. When it comes to energy, we, in New York, we net meter. So at the end of the day, we own the energy that's in our system, so we buy it to fill our system, we sell it to discharge it, but there's not a lot of money made off of that. It's not the primary product we're selling.
I was more concerned with what you're paying as opposed to how you...
So yeah, we buy energy off the wholesale system. We sell it in the wholesale system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we in NYISO, a battery system can transact at the wholesale level, and in any settlement period, we net the energy back and forth. That makes sense.
I think the explanation, if I may offer it, is because you're responding to the signals from the NYISO control center. You're providing the service that you can take up or give out according to their signal.
Yes.
That's the service that's being provided.
Yes.
You may, at some point in time, have charged the batteries so that your capacity is in waiting. That's his question about buying electricity.
Yes.
But you're not having to buy the electricity every several seconds when the high-tech control center and those guys at the seven desks are running ancillary services and counting on your capacity. I think you could put his mind at ease that you don't have to worry about the cost of buying electricity because you're providing a response to that signal.
Yeah, that's right. We're not purchasing significant amounts of electricity on a gross or a net basis. I think that you used that as a much more eloquent way than me stumbling through the explanation. I lost my slot here. Let's see.
Use the scroll wheel.
There we go. Oh, a little too excited. The scroll wheel. Oh yeah. So you will. I'll talk about that in a second. So that's just. So these are the individual services now. Kind of more. I kind of got off track there. So. Two services are capacity and ancillary services. So the capacity service is basically we're replacing these what traditionally is provided by thermal peaking plants. The background here is I believe a combined natural gas combined cycle plant, not one of ours. And so the service there was providing when there's unexpected peak demand. So if there is a bunch of air conditioners turn on all at once or at night. If there's a large heating demand or lighting demand, we're providing those peak services. So when the grid gets to the absolute top, when all the generators that were planned to operate that day are all operating, and there's still more demand, then a project like ours can come online and provide short durations of power for 1, 2, 3, 4 hours if necessary. Almost always in New York, peaking services are usually in the 1 to 2 hour range. Before other plants take up that slack or other solutions are found. So we would anticipate our peaking services really being in this 1, 2, 3 hour range. But we can provide, we're a 4 hour battery, so we can provide up to 4 hours of services, provided we're charged correctly for that. And part of the management that both us and the NYISO do is managing what's called state of charge. So looking for the likelihood of a peaking event coming and making sure the battery is sufficiently charged for, in advance of that peaking event. And that's all part of the service requirements that we have to follow in order to be a participant in the NISO market. And of course, that we're, you know, we're providing this emissions free. You know, batteries don't provide, don't make any new emissions themselves. You know, right now, the grid is a mix of different emissions amounts. But as the New York grid moves to be a lower carbon or low carbon emissions, that'll change. That'll lower the emissions of the overall power system. So we don't add to the emissions. But of course, if we're charging, you know, we're taking power off the grid, whatever that emissions mix is. But that'll, the emissions mix will reduce over time as the grid transitions. So this is the kind of a snapshot of what I was trying to struggle through earlier. You know, traditionally, it varies day to day, but in most cases, the demand in the power grid goes like this, that in the middle of the night, 2, 3, 4 in the morning is the lowest, and then as people turn things on and as the demand increases, throughout the day, it usually peaks, depending on the season, but usually peaks in the late afternoon, early evening. This is the traditional shape. As you start including solar and other sorts of renewable generation, the shape changes a little bit. But for the most part, the current peak and the forecasted peak in the next in the coming years is still peaking in the evening. And one of the challenges as you add more solar is the fact that for most times of the year, as the sun goes down, there's still quite a bit of demand, which is then increased, the overall demand is increased as that solar turns down, as the sun sets, people are still up and at it, doing their things, and so there's it kind of enhances this evening peak. So that would be a time that we provide sometimes capacity services, but throughout the day, regardless of the actual amount of generation, there's always this kind of minute-by-minute variation. So what this represents is, this is, you know, when you look at that line, it's one nice, straight, smooth line. But what it actually is as people turn lights on and off, as a wind turbine, you know, gets a gust of wind or the wind dies down or a solar panel has a cloud go over it or a cloud pass thoroughly, the actual demand is always changing, constantly changing. And right now what the grid operator does is it has a certain number of generators that are connected to the grid that it ramps up and down. So think of it like a gas pedal in your car, and there's certain generators out there, thermal generators, that the grid operator hits the gas or lets up on the gas and kind of uses that throttling to follow the load as closely as possible. But because of the way those generators work, like your car, you can't go from zero to 60 instantaneously. You have to kind of gradually ramp up, and just like you don't want to slam the brakes on, you got to gradually slow down. Currently in the grid, you never can actually catch up to where you want to be. So the grid operator is always chasing the desired demand point. And the grid's designed to have some flexibility. So, you know, it's designed to be somewhat resilient, and they're designed to not always be there. But at the end of the day, what always is happening is the grid operator, no matter how hard they try, is either over-generating or under-generating. And that wastes fuel, or that stresses equipment if you're under-generating. What's going to compound the problem is as the grid transitions and takes more of those fossil generators off, that ability to throttle up and down becomes more challenging. Because solar generators and wind generators, while a lot of the new technologies can throttle up and down, a lot of times those plants either aren't capable. If there's not the right resource, if there's not sun, there's not wind, you can't make power from a solar project at night. There's just not, without storage, there's not any energy to make. And oftentimes those projects depend on every single megawatt hour that they can make being put onto the grid. You know, they're not designed to be throttled down when they're not needed. So what battery storage does is it allows to replicate that throttling up and down that a thermal generator currently does. It allows you to do it with batteries because the batteries can absorb or discharge energy as needed and simulate that throttling up and down, but they can do it much more efficiently. There's no wasted fuel. The batteries can change output within milliseconds, often faster than the equipment can detect the change. And so it's a much more efficient way of doing all of that. This is what we call frequency regulation. So again, capacity services are the being there for the peaks, and the frequency regulation is this second-by-second, minute-by-minute matching of load and generation. So that's your 101 on electric generation markets. We're here afterwards with questions, but I'll take any quick questions you have now. Yes, sir.
So your batteries aren't always fully charged because want to be able to take energy when there's excess capacity?
Yep. Yeah, so the simple way to look at it is our, you know, on a basic sense, our idea would be we're right in the middle all the time, that we always can go up or go down depending on what the requirements are. In reality, it's a little more complex because we're looking for future events and we're trying to manage health and that kind of thing, so we, you know, it's not always 50%. But yeah, the usefulness doesn't come in the fact that we can, that we're fully charged, like your fully charged cell phone. The usefulness comes in the fact that we can both discharge or charge. So we generally, if you were to sample a battery project, like our projects in Illinois, and take the average charge, it's going to be in the middle someplace, in the 40 to 60% range, because that's where you end up being, because you're able to swing back and forth.
And if your batteries weren't there, where would this excess capacity go?
So right now, the solutions are two things. Is that the grid is designed to ride up a little bit of excess capacity. Sometimes if you notice at your house, like if you were to turn on, you know, a large, like when your air conditioner kicks in, maybe your lights dim a little bit. That's the micro example of over and under frequency, is the light's dimming. And the system's designed to handle a little bit of that. You know, it's always designed to sway a little bit. But if you get too far to either end, then what most likely happens is the protection systems will start tripping offline. So you might have an outage either at your house or at a distribution circuit. So right now what happens is the grid operator closely monitors this and will throttle up and down a certain subset of thermal generators. So it'll, you know, if there's too much energy in the system, it'll send electronically those generators instructions to slow down. And they can't respond instantaneously, but the grid operator knows how, you know, they know a lot, they know how fast they can respond, they know their track record, so they know kind of how to do that. The challenge comes that as those generators age, they eventually will come, they'll be retired. And so battery projects are important to replace that. They also are more competitive because when the grid operator is mostly focused on cost. And so they want to find the cheapest solution for a ratepayer. And so when they're deciding which generators to provide that frequency regulation service, the throttling up and down, those generators bid in a price. They say, for X dollars, I'll do this for you. And for a gas generator, they need to build in the lost revenue from up and down, the excess gas they have to burn to throttle up, to throttle down, the inefficiencies of being at different places in their generator curve. So that's all priced in right now. And what batteries do is because, you know, we have a cost. We still have to pay for the project and pay for the batteries. But because we don't have any wasted generation, our business model is that we can provide those services at a lower cost and be more efficient at it. And that's where we're coming in right now, to provide those services. And as the state looks to move to a more efficient, greener grid, and more regulations are placed on generators that have fossil fuel components, we think that our generation will become more competitive, which is our business model. You know, we'll have to compete. There are some incentives for storage to get built in New York, but when it comes to actually providing the service, we have to compete head-to-head with those gas generators and diesel generators. It's in New York, mostly gas generators. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll be around afterwards. This could go all day long. Bridget.
I'm not from Catskill, but from the town of Ulster. I just wanted to say that we worked with the Flight Path first before with against. And we had a ferocious battle for over a year. From 2017, the end of 2017, summer, when the battery storage really took off. We knew that was going to happen because the energy economists that we were working with, you know, told us this was going to happen. So we were hoping that the fossil fuel paper generation plant was not going to be in the cards. I've always felt a very good relationship with Peter, Chris, and Aaron, and I always felt that I, you know, certainly could talk to the town, our town board, and see the process, and that was hellacious, the details involved. But it was good. It was really good because a lot of citizens became involved. Our citizen group subsequently learned more about power generation than we ever cared to, and was mostly, we felt, out of self-protection. As the state moved toward, as Aaron was outlining earlier, the 2030 goals of 70%, we were building 25 goals of 6,000 megawatts of storage really became the answer. And we felt that right along, and I'm sure that Chris and Peter, you know, knew that was coming, but pursuing a business model that we didn't favor. But I always felt that the process was fair and just and very honest on all sides of this. And when we landed where you're beginning, we were absolutely thrilled that this kind of project was going to be in our town, certainly as a replacement, but also it just makes a whole lot of sense to catch the renewable energy that's out there, and also to save what's on the grid and have a more intelligent way of managing the grid for grid calls. We love the idea, so we're in favor. I told Peter, I said, the reason I'm here is to support you guys. I know you got some steps to take, and that's totally Catskill of business, but I just want to say from a citizen's point of view and as a group of citizens that
Any questions about how it works? Otherwise, I'm going to turn over to Chris here, and he can talk about some of the more detailed design elements, especially the fire safety and those components. Yes, sir.
Is it beneficial anywhere in the model for you to have your own generation? In other words, your own solar farm or your own wind farm connected to or within short distance of your storage?
I think, so the short answer is no, because we're, it definitely complements it, but the way the energy market in New York works is there's not a strong financial incentive for us to do that or for a wind farm to partner with us. It's kind of, wind energy and solar energy, which we are very familiar with, in New York, really to sell energy, and right now, the New York market does not burden the renewable generation with the cost of integrating it. In other markets in the United States, the wind developer has to bear the cost of integrating their project into the grid. And here those costs are essentially refereed by the grid operator, NYISO. And so the wind project owners don't have a real reason to pair up with storage. There is some, NYSERDA, the agency that incentivizes wind and renewables and now storage, does have some programs where they've tried to incentivize renewable developers to pair storage at their sites. I'm not aware of any projects that have actually gotten built in that model. And really, the crux of that is mostly to save on infrastructure costs by sharing a new substation and not having to build kind of two of the same thing. And for these projects, based on we took that into account when we sited them and looked for substations that already had existing expansion capabilities. So the North Catskill substation already has sufficient capacity on the low voltage bus to build our project without having to do substantial upgrades. So I think there is some need for that, but right now that's all managed at the grid operator level. They do the balancing of renewables and other elements. Okay, Chris, go ahead.
You guys thought that was riveting. Hang on tight. I'm here to get into even more details. So I'm Chris McKissick, Chief Operating Officer for GlidePath. My group and my team is responsible for the engineering design, procurement, construction of the projects, and taking projects that Peter's team and Aaron's team develop and turn them into operating projects. So my plan is to talk you through some of the design details in the technical componentry that's in the sites, show you some pictures of the projects that we have built and are building right now, and answer questions about safety and some of the things that we've done proactively about safety and environmental concerns on the project. So I'm going to get close to the screen here and kind of stay out of the way a little bit, but kind of the general construction here, you've got two different projects that have different foundation types. This is drilled pier foundations. These are slab-on-grade foundations. Really depends on what the geotech looks like and some of the more detailed engineering that happens after we get through the negative declaration, the secret process, and all that, that will determine exactly how we go about the foundations. But what you have here are battery containers sitting on concrete. Peter described, and I've got some pictures here, but you know, you've got a number of batteries depending on the vendor that you go with. Some of them, the battery cells look like just standard D-cell batteries. Some of them look like VHS cartridges. Some of them look like sort of long pouches. And so, generally speaking, I think we'll contemplate the VHS tape size batteries is the most common size that you have. Just, you know, hundreds of these in stacks, and everything, as Peter described, is very, I would describe it as Legos, you know, that you've got these kind of repeated pattern, you've got multiple batteries in a module, the modules slide into the racks and are all connected together with a controller or a protector on top. Each of those are wired in series like a set of Christmas lights, and that's what your DC battery system is inside the containers. DC voltage is not what the grid operates on. The difference between DC is direct current and AC, alternating current. The grid operates on AC. Batteries are DC. That's why if you look at, you know, any kind of laptops or cell phone chargers, you've got kind of a block on the plug. There's actually conversion going on inside that little plug, like your iPhone charger. That converts the AC from the grid to the DC that charges your phone. So what you need here to connect the batteries to the grid is a converter. It's a PCS or an inverter that converts from DC to AC back and forth. And then what you see here, these green devices, these are transformers. That just steps the voltage up to the right level to match what the grid has. These are the same things you'll see as you walk down the street and the utility uses transformers all over the place on pole tops to step the voltage down to your outlet voltage. As it says here, it's about, a 6 month to 1 year construction cycle, depending on some of the complexity, lead times on equipment, and just making sure that you give concrete time to cure and all those kinds of things. And the last note is that we are committed to using local union labor. I've actually got a meeting with labor leaders tomorrow. We have done this in Ulster. We've signed an MOU to use local labor, and we're planning on doing the same here in Catskill. This is a little bit better view of what's going on inside the container. So I talked about the VHS style cartridges. They're lined up in here with these plates that connect positive, negative, etc. Those are all wired together in what's called a module. So this module is what's going on right here or right here. Each of those modules are then slid into a rack, which then you see these red and black connectors that connects these modules and series. Again, it's very, a lot of engineers would make things sound very complex. There are very complicated elements to this and elements in the controllers, but at the end of the day, the construction and the architecture of the system is relatively simple. Here is a picture from about 2 weeks ago of our project in Texas. You can see our stacks or racks being installed in the containers. This is a very similar similar design to what we're proposing here in Catskill. That you've got, these are the same sites. I can go backwards. That is the same site. So progression picture here that you've got the same pad foundations with the containers on top of them. And this is them being loaded with the batteries. So they're just being installed with pallet jacks. They come pre-wired in the racks just like that. So they're boxing, the uncrating happens outside the container. They get loaded in the container. They're pre-wired within each rack. And then the wiring goes along the top of the container. Now to talking, to go into safety and environment. We've done a number of these projects, and we look very carefully at where we site projects. Having to balance a number of concerns, from citizens' concerns, from regulators' concerns, from our own operational concerns. We're very happy that this project has less than a tenth of an acre of wetland disturbance, no archaeological or cultural resources expected. And no signs of, we've done studies and no signs of significant natural communities. So we're very happy about those things from an environmental perspective. But then also moving on to the safety side and how the system works, I mentioned that it's a very simple architecture, but there are critical things that go on within the controls and within how the project is dispatched. We have UPS backup in case there's a loss of power that keeps the system in what's called a fail-safe mode. That's important. I used to work for utilities and at power plants, and fail-safe is an important characteristic when designing anything like that. That means that if you lose power, if you get disconnected from the grid, if you know your circuit breaker opens up, when you have something that occurs, you want to make sure that your failure mode keeps the system safe and keeps the area safe. So our fire suppression and fire detection systems are on UPS systems that have a critical safety backup. Our controllers are backed up. That if it ever does lose control power, breakers automatically open up and get disconnected from the grid. So our system will be designed with redundancy in mind to make sure that all the critical safety systems are always online and have a fail-safe system. We do have onboard fire suppression systems. So that's anytime you're dealing with batteries, electricity, anything like that, you want to be aware. You plan for the worst, and then that won't happen. So you want to be ready for if something were to happen, how would the system respond? So there are dry chemical agents, aerosol fire suppression systems that will be installed in each one of the containers. That's one of the things that we do like about the containerized design, is that you've got this isolation between containers that allows, if something were to go wrong in one rack or in one module, that it's isolated to that container that has multiple fire suppression detectors in, and the system will shut down, fire suppression will go off, and extinguish any fires. We've also been working not only on these projects, but for example, I'm blue in the face about our Texas project that we're building right now, but there we've engaged a safety agency to work with us to come up with a site-specific safety plan. We think that's very important. That it's easy to say from, I work out of Chicago, the system's over here, it's easy to say that, it's working, everything's fine, and sort of design a universal safety program. What we think is very important is to have a site-specific safety program, that having a plan that you work through with first responders, that you alert people how to respond, what to do, who to alert, and how to work with the system, not only when you initially design and build the project, but to do regular training and updating is important. Firefighters rotate on and off. Not everybody, people might be sick the day you do training. It's important that we found to do regular updates for those kind of trainings. This is a high-level view of energy storage track record. I think that this is new, likely new for all of you guys. We feel like it's old hat because we've been doing this for a number of years now, but it's an important reminder to show everybody where there is a very well-advanced industry of battery storage projects, grid-connected at a scale like this throughout the globe and across the U.S., batteries aren't new. Batteries are 100, 150 years old. Lithium-ion batteries have become, commercially, normalized over the last, several decades. But you've even seen it already deployed throughout the grid, our grid and globally. The other thing that's important to note is that the system that we'll be installing will be fully tested to UL, IEEE, NFPA standards. This isn't a science experiment. This is something that has been thought through and designed. The chemistry is designed and become stable and safe. The systems around it are designed to be safe. And not only are designed to be safe, and you trust a vendor to do it, all these systems are sent to nationally recognized testing laboratories to go through UL testing and test the design, to test the actual response and how the systems react under different stressors. These are fire codes, they're energy storage for lithium-ion battery codes, it's UL codes for the entire system, not just the cells. It's inverter codes that go through the safety of how the inverters interact with the grid and make sure that you've got the right amount of shutdown, the right response time, all the fail-safe things I talked about earlier is built into all of these companies. This goes into just sort of a, I would say, a somewhat layman's version of what we do to make sure the system is safe. So even from buying the batteries from the vendor and having them shipped to site, you have to make sure to take care of how the batteries are shipped. So the batteries are shipped, I mentioned, in the crated boxes. Tamper-proof tilt and shock sensors are put on all those at the factory when they leave the loading dock and stay on there all the way to the site. So you make sure that if a system is dropped in shipping, if it's shaken, if it's tilted too much, that you reject it and send it back for testing, or that you do a further inspection, that you make sure that care was taken in shipping to get the battery system to the site. There are fail-safe systems to prevent overcharging, that on every module level and every rack level, they have individual battery management systems that detect what the state of charge is of the batteries and make sure that you don't try to push it past that 100%. So you're not just relying on a computer system at the site level to say stop charging, that each individual subsystem is actually prevented from overcharging. I mentioned the HVAC systems. The HVAC is important for the battery systems because as you're charging and discharging, and if you're doing a lot of charging and discharging in any given day, the batteries get warm, fills the containers with warm air, and it degrades the ability for the batteries to charge and discharge. They slow down. And so the HVAC is important to keeping the system operating optimally. And as I mentioned, that there are certain control features that interact with the container and with the batteries that tie into the HVAC system. For example, if somebody opens the doors and keeps the doors open, the HVAC system is not going to be as efficient, so the batteries will shut down and shut down the HVAC until maintenance is done and the doors are closed again. Short circuit protection. Even at the individual cell level, there's short circuit protection. This is fuses, circuit breakers, those kind of things. Anybody remembers the screw fuses that you had in the breaker panel downstairs? That is built into the batteries at the module and cell level, so that if you get to a point where everything else breaks down and you're still charging a battery that's fully charged somehow, the individual cells will open up the protective devices and go off on. So you've got this layers and layers of redundancy here again, that the goal is to have a fail-safe architecture. The other thing that I wanted to show you guys is that the condition monitoring. So this is, we had to zero everything out since we were putting this up on the website, but this is a screenshot of our monitoring system for our Myersdale battery storage project. So this is a live system that we have in Myersdale, Pennsylvania. It's a 18 megawatt system, so it's slightly smaller on the megawatts. It's shorter duration too. Peter mentioned the different services that a battery can provide. This system is in Pennsylvania and is only needed for frequency regulation, so the short bursts up and down, not for that capacity to move peakers offline. And so it's a shorter duration battery, and so there's only three containers at this site. And this is a visual diagram of those three containers, the individual racks that as the controller could sit there, we can sit there and click into each one of the racks and look at cell level voltages, current, temperatures, humidity. Not only can we look at this in real time, but we've got this information back 4 years worth of data on a 1 and 2 second interval. And so we do run assessments and analyses to see how the system is performing to be able to predict future performance and make sure that if things are degrading faster than they should be, that we take it offline and look at it and send it to the lab for testing.
Ready? wrist control back.
All right.
I know time's getting short, and just to wrap things up, some of the key takeaways: that energy storage itself is backed by leading environmental advocacy organizations. Key benefit is that it will help get these dirty peaker plants off the grid by replacing them with a better, more efficient, and more economical service. And it's a major enabling technology, again, for that wind and solar deployment. So storage is going to be a really critical bridge to bring those more variable technologies on the line. It is, as Chris pointed out, this is well-tested, safe technology. This is not new, although we recognize it's new to this area. And that brings me to the last point of it's a chance here for Catskill to be truly leading the way. As Regis mentioned, in Ulster, it's something they're very proud of, this role of transforming New York's grid for a cleaner future here. Last thing I want to show you is just review of the project site. As you can see on these maps, this is the aerial view of where it sits, just north of the Route 23 interchange with 9W. This is the current, the existing conditions. So I'm standing on 9W, trying not to get hit by a car, and looking south, or south over here into the north. And here's how the project will be sited. So it's sort of a visualization of where these containers will sit on the property. So the main entrance to the site will be through here, and then it goes around back to both sides. And we do have the site plans here on a poster if you want to look really closely at the specific features. But this is sort of the overall arrangement. And that is, again, that site plan showing the driveways. That is the information we have for you. I know there have been many questions along the way, but as we wrap up, are there any additional questions or comments you'd like to share? Yes, sir.
Why this size? Why not bigger? Why not smaller? And what is the lifespan of the individual battery and the facility as a whole?
So we tend to pride ourselves in having worked for utility and understanding the grid. That's something that we're very proud of, trying to find right fits for the grid. So as we look for sites, we look for locations where the grid not only can handle an interconnection or can handle the additional capacity, but also sizing it right so that you're not causing overloads onto the grid. One of the things about the process to connect to the grid is that if you size something where the grid can't handle it, then you end up having to upgrade the grid, do transmission line upgrades, new transformers, new substations. So we very specifically look for substation locations where not only is it a reasonable place to put it, a reasonable size, we also look for market indications of where it can benefit the grid the most. And I think that, you looked at one of the slides showed the development of wind and solar throughout New York. One of the things that has been proposed and is moving through the works at the New York ISO is additional transmission lines to move renewables into New York City. And that's not something that we think is a positive, but really is an indicator that if we strengthen the grid in this region, maybe we can stave off future transmission improvements and provide that reliability here where the enhancements are needed and that the grid operators are signaling more upgrades are needed, but do it in a more reasonable fashion than a lot of new transmission lines bringing wind from the west and into the east. The other question about battery lifespans, batteries that we're looking at now are looking at 20 and 25 year lifespans. I think we can get up to a 15 or 20 year warranty on the batteries. And so you're really looking at, I think there are a lot of people, I think of my cell phone, and after a couple of years it starts to have terrible battery life. Part of that is because if you actually look at how your cell phones are supposed to be used, none of us do it the right way. you know, that you leave it plugged in overnight and you let it charge, you know, get down to zero. And that's, so that's part of the complexity of the control system and you know, us pouring so much engineering effort into designing a proper control system to make sure that you have that life. But they're looking at 10 to 15,000 cycles of battery life, which gets us out to about 20, 25 years in just the individual battery cells. Now, some cells may degrade faster than others, and I showed you the monitoring system. And that as you see cells fade, what's nice about that modular setup is that we could take a module pack out, put a new module pack in, rebalance the system a little bit, and keep the system going on beyond, well beyond that.
And one thing I think, if it's not on, on this website already, we could put up there, there is a, the project will have a end-of-life disposal plan, so there'll be a plan that we work with the manufacturer to make sure that we're not just throwing away the batteries. You know, first of all, from just a pure business standpoint, the lithium-ion batteries have value. There's the chemicals in the batteries. There is value to us, and there's value to the manufacturer. And so we'll have a plan in place, and we'll post kind of the outline of that plan on the website. And we'll plan in place to recycle those cells as they reach the end of their life. And we'll post that. And there's also, you know, with all of our projects, we do have a project decommissioning plan. So, you know, the cells have different lifespans, as Chris mentioned. You know, we'll replace some before others and kind of always be swapping the cells in and out. But then when the project reaches the end of its life, you know, we'll have a plan before we start building the project of how to clean the site up, make sure we pull all of our equipment off the site, and restore the site to a, you know, not the way we found it, because we can't make trees grow overnight, but we'll put it back in a condition where it's kind of on the pathway to be used for a new use. And we'll plan all that ahead of time and make sure that that's all public and clear how we do that. But anyway, I think the idea is that the project, its initial life will be the 20 to 25 years, and you know, a lot of the infrastructure will last much longer than that. So I think, you know, as the project ages, we'll figure out what to do with it as it goes. But yeah, 25 years is probably the right answer for today.
What about your relationship with are you effectively in some kind of partnership with Central Hudson, or are you insulated from them legislatively? How?
So we have so Central Hudson has a federally governed interconnection process. So in the United States, in these organized markets like New York is, there's the Federal Power Act. And that requires equal access to the transmission system. And so we have currently an interconnection agreement that anybody can go get with Central Hudson. So we have rights to interconnect the Central Hudson system. We have to pay them certain costs associated with our project being connected. They're obligated to give us those connection rights. It's the same interconnection agreement that a wind project signs, that a gas project signs. It's non-discriminatory based on your technology. So we have
similar to connecting buildings like this to the grid, that they have to connect you, and the building or the new load bears the cost of that connection.
Yep. And then our business is actually not with Central Hudson. They provide our on-ramp to the grid, but then we are, you know, our kind of financial aspect is we trade at the wholesale market that the entity called the New York Independent System Operator runs, and that's kind of a clearinghouse for these transactions, and they have a market set up to do all of this stuff. And at the end, Central Hudson is also a participant in that market. They're on the buy side or on the sell side, but the New York ISO is our customer. The check we get will say New York ISO on it. this is our plan for the night, so we'll stay around.
One more, can I?
Yeah, of course.
So quinoa, really good for you. Everybody think it's awesome, and then you find out that they're clear cutting the Amazon. The elements that go into batteries, awesome, better than fossil fuels. Are we doing damage somewhere that we're going to regret 50 years down the road?
So we don't think so. We've actually got at our investors level, Quinbrook is the entity that owns us. They're part of they're signatories to PRI, and I don't know what that stands for, but part of their process and part of their what they have set up as, you know, kind of global citizenry here is to understand answers to questions like that and to look into, for example, where are the raw materials coming from that are being used, and where they, how are they processed in creating the batteries, and then ultimately is it a net benefit? So we've looked into it. We don't believe that there's a broader issue that we're generating by building a battery storage complex.
So as Peter mentioned, we'll hang around if you have any questions or I forgot to mention. So we talked about preserving the rural view. We understand the view shed is important. So from 9W, you have a lot of people coming through, visiting this region, looking for fall foliage. We want to make sure this project fits well with this community and the character. So we're proposing several options for visual barrier that would go along the southern section of the project. And those options are there on a poster, and we ask for your vote. So there's some stickers. If you have an opinion and you'd like one versus the other, throw a sticker under that, and we'll communicate that to the planning board, the town board. Ultimately, it's their call where we go, but I think the community's voice will be important. Okay, thank you very much again. Thank you for your questions and your attention.
What's that?
Thanks.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so we'll...
I think we're just...